When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm Andy Wilson along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hey, Andy.
And also Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, Andrew.
Today's guest on Music Buzz is a singer, songwriter, and guitar player who spent 10 years as the lead guitarist of Band of Horses. He has also released four acclaimed solo records. His latest release is called New Lost Ages. It's out now and it's really good. And we're going to talk about the tunes on it. Welcome to the Music Buzz, Tyler Ramsey.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on the Music Buzz.
I normally start talking about the new project and the New Lost Ages. I've got a favorite song, and I think it was maybe the one you released first as a single. Flair. I'm going to say, even though it's already been out earlier, that it's with Dane Clark's pick of the month.
Oh, man.
For coolest song I've heard in a long time. Well, so let me talk a little bit. I mean, it reminds me. Immediately started reminding me, and it doesn't really sound like it, but it reminds me of Expecting to Fly by the Buffalo Springfield, one of my favorite songs of all time. Your voice has that haunting, vulnerable quality that Neil had back then when he was younger. I mean, it's like Neil Young in tune, but I love the sparseness and the guitar tones. And I knew Neil when he toured with Shannon McNally.
Oh, okay.
With the Mellencamp, they were our opening act for, I don't know, at least like a 3-month deal or something. So I didn't get to know him real well, but we hang out, drink a couple beers and, you know, share songs and stuff. But I love the song, man. Somebody Swim to Me. It's really beautiful. Can you talk about it, your relationship with him and how this song came about? Really great song.
Yeah, I'll definitely talk about it. Thank you so much for those compliments. That's really nice to hear. So I didn't know Neil that well either. I did a little run of shows opening for him and his band Circles Around the Sun. It was kind of just by chance. They were coming through. I live just outside of Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay.
And they were playing in town. And I think they had somebody cancel some dates as their opener, and I had met their manager at some point in the past along the way, and just happened to bump into all those guys in my favorite local guitar shop called Heyday, and they were all in there just kind of sniffing around before their show. And the manager recognized me, and we talked for a minute, and then he introduced me to all the guys, and then and then shortly after that, I think they reached out somehow and found me and said, hey, do you want to open these 5 or 6 shows? I can't remember how many it was, but that was the week that was coming up. So I just jumped on. I said, yeah, I'll be there. And I went out and got to know Neil a little bit. And they were just, man, they were so sweet to me and just, you know, sat and watched my set every night. And they were checking in on me. I was driving by myself and they were on their bus. So they'd check in on me on the drives. And just really, really connected with Neil and thought at some point we would, you know, do some work together. I had fantasies of getting him to play guitar or getting him to maybe produce something or, but yeah, that, so when that all went down with him, it just shook me up because I was really like connecting with him in a way that was, felt like we were real similar and our personalities were kind of similar, but I felt like the place we were in our careers too felt kind of similar. He was just kind of post Chris Robinson Brotherhood. I was, you know, post Band of Horses, and we were just kind of building these new things, you know? So, yeah.
Wow. It's an awesome tribute to him, man.
Yeah. Thank you.
Beautiful song. Song of the month.
Song of the month. Of course, it's what, February? You should have said the song of the year at least.
The first 3 months at least. Yeah. I mean,
I got to point that out. Man.
Until spring at least.
I've noticed that you're, and I make this as just an out, sort of an outside observation, but, and it's because I'm a big fan of it myself, but you seem very comfortable with the beauty of melancholy in the way you write and the way you structure your music. I just happened across the live thing you did at Pace Studios in Austin, where you had that long guitar opening for Darkest Cloud.
Oh, yeah.
And when I was listening to the guitar playing, I was hearing some stills, but I was definitely hearing Bruce Coburn, you know.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, lovely sort of picking style that you have. Yeah, but really, really lovely. And your lyrics too. I mean, when I stumbled across, and I believe everything could hear it if you just lean in.
Yeah.
I love well-written lyrics, and that seems to be something you're consistently good at.
I appreciate that. Yeah, melancholy music is something that I, you know, have always just kind of like gravitated towards, and it feels right for me. I mean, I don't know. It's not something I try to force or anything. It's just where I'm at a lot of the time.
And it's not about being woeful or sad. I mean, look at Peter Gabriel. I mean, he's the prince of melancholy. You know, he does it well.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's a lot of beauty in it. Like I say, there's a lot of beauty in that approach to song structure and harmonies.
Yeah, thank you. And the guitar style. Yeah, I love every time I hear Bruce Coburn, I love what I'm hearing. He's one of those people that I've yet to like dive into the catalog, but I swear, like just yesterday, he popped up somewhere. Like I heard a song or something, and I was like,
his last record has got a song called Orders,
yeah,
which is one of the coolest songs I've heard in a long time. That'll be that was that one song of the month of ways back.
Okay, so,
but yeah, that's one that everybody should check out too. It's about scripture too. You know, Orders said to love them all, and it goes through the list of people that you want to hate, and I don't know, it's very interesting, but the whole thing is that finger picking that he's got.
Yeah,
well, check out all his pre Bruce Coburn band material. The stuff like High Winds, White Skies is a brilliant album. High Winds, White Sky, even that song alone is gorgeous.
I'm writing these down as you say.
And his first solo and his first album produced by Gene Martinek, just Bruce Coburn, was a lovely, you know, Going to the Country was a great song. But I used to watch him at the Riverboat before that whole part of Toronto was gentrified. It was really a street full of houses where you'd go to buy hash. Basically, it was a cool, it was a cool street in Toronto. But it had a coffee house called the Riverboat where Joni Mitchell and Murray McLaughlin and those people would play. But I would watch him. I'd be sitting 6 feet away from him listening and watching him play. And
he was a Berkeley guy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And he also busked in Paris, and which is where he says he got a lot of his chops together because he was playing every day.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Two more songs if you want to. Fascist Architecture and Laughter. Bruce.
Is that on a new album?
Classics. That's old stuff from the 70s.
Okay.
They're just great tunes.
I'm just going to have to dive into the whole catalog.
But those are great.
But you'll see what I'm talking about. When I heard you playing, I could have sworn you were a fan, because when I listened to your playing on Darkest Cloud, I thought, oh, this guy's a Bruce Coburn fan, clearly. And
yeah, That's so yeah. Every time I hear it, I do connect to it, but I never have really explored it that much. My love for the guitar is definitely based on fingerstyle guitar. I just always loved that. And I listened early on. I was listening to, like, you know, all kinds of things, like people that composed for the acoustic guitar specifically. I would get into, like, Leo Kottke. I'm a big fan of.
Oh, sure.
I'm a big fan of Michael Hedges. I'm a huge fan of his work. And just, like, I was delved into the whole new age world for a little while, just because that the earlier stuff that was kind of like, it had like this folk quality,
yeah, or
this Americana kind of quality to it, but it was like these beautiful compositions, and it's one person with an acoustic guitar just making this whole world happen. Yeah. And I loved it. And that's kind of what I've pursued over the years, is just the ability to take a guitar and try and make it, you know, stand on its own without any, not much accompaniment.
Well, there was a time when people like Loggins and Messina, Seals and Crofts, and all those people would sort of command a stage with nothing more than just mandolin. Well,
and even before that, how about Donovan, who had that finger picking style that he showed John Lennon when they were in India, which he used on all the songs on the White Album, and thereafter was Donovan's finger picking. Go back and listen to Gift from a Flower to a Garden. There's a whole children's record. It's half the record is children's songs, and it's just him and his guitar.
Really?
It's fantastic.
I saw
those British, like Bert Jansch and John Renbourn.
Yeah, those guys are fabulous.
Way into that stuff, too.
Yeah.
Are you a John Martin fan?
I am a John Martin fan, yeah. Definitely.
He's pretty amazing. Yeah.
Roy Harper. I'm huge Roy Harper.
Oh, Roy Harper. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hats off too.
Yeah, definitely.
I listened to the new record over the weekend. It's fantastic. These Ghosts, obviously, is the first song. Great first song.
Cool riff on that too, man. Because it's like a deceiving of, okay, oh, it goes over the bar line.
That's actually kind of based on, because I'm also a fan of like kind of Indian classical music, and there's a mandolin player named U.Srinivas. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right at all, but he's passed away. But if you go listen to his, I think even what Peter Gabriel's label, the world kind of world label that he had.
The World, whatever, yeah.
I can't remember what it was, but they put a record out of his on that. And it was just the first one I found. And I just fell in love with that kind of like style. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. And that, for a long time, I still am obsessed with that music. But that intro is kind of a play on that style. It's just like me kind of noodling around on the guitar, and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool, and it kind of loops around,
but it's like it makes it an odd bar. It's very cool. Yeah. Drummers love that kind of stuff. Man. It's like, okay, I know what you're doing.
Yeah. I also like the. Awesome. The Won't Get Fooled Again style B3, the kind of the eighth note. It's lovely. It reminded me of Won't Get Fooled Again and that rabbit part that, you know, it's got that nice sort of lilt and tension. It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That was some studio magic at the kind of towards the end where I was like building that part, and we put in that percussive. Bup, 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 bup. Yeah. Kind of carries it a little bit.
Where was the new record made?
I went out to, so I reached out to Phil Eck, who, you know, produced a lot of the Sub Pop records that are just legendary albums, and did like the Shins and the Fleet Foxes and Built to Spill, Modest Mouse, all those things. He and I had bumped into each other again after years and years. He saw me walking down the street in Seattle. I was playing a show, and he texted me, "Are you in Seattle?" And he came by after the show, and we talked, and, you know, planted the seed that we were going to do a record together. And after a lot of work and me figuring out how I was going to pay for the record, we decided to work together, and he wanted to do out there in Seattle. So we did it at some of the studios out there that he's worked in a lot over the years, Avast and Stone Gossard's studio out there. And so, yeah, that was about a month all told, but in a couple different sessions, we got it all done out there.
How about the players on the record? Can you talk a little bit about who's on the record?
Yeah. Morgan Henderson plays bass, and he plays in Fleet Foxes, but he's not the bass player in the band. He's side stage. He's like a multi-instrumentalist, but bass is his main instrument. So he was the bass player. Sean Lane, who's playing with Heart right now, was the drummer, and he has worked with Phil a lot over the years. He was kind of like maybe even started out kind of just drum teching in the studio for Phil. And then, but man, those guys together were just a force. It was kind of coming out of the shutdown times when I hadn't really gotten to play with many people in a while. And, to walk in the room and have those guys in there and just be like, man, this is good. And it made me a little nervous too, to come out of my kind of hibernation into that world of just stellar musicians was really cool. And then once we got all that done, I did a lot of the work myself, just Phil and I and the engineer. And then I reached out to my friend, Carl Bramel, who plays in My Morning Jacket.
Oh yeah, he's from Indiana.
Yeah.
I've played sessions with Carl.
Yeah. He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Carl and I are buddies, and we do some work together. We've done some tours together where we play the whole night on stage together. We'll just play each other's songs back and forth and
wow,
sing harmony.
Tell him Dane said hello when you talk to him. It's probably been 10 years or.
Oh, really?
It was session in Bloomington for
Mike Blanchett. He was an Old Pike. Remember that band, Old Pike?
He was an Old Pike. Yeah.
Yeah. They opened that Mellencamp show, the New Year's Eve show in 99 that I worked on and you played at the field house when we were all worried about Y2K and the whole world blowing up.
I remember well. We're still here.
What's his instrument?
He's the guitarist. He's like the lead guitar player, or like, you know, they have multiple, you know, him and Jim James play lead guitars, but.
I see. Yeah.
But he also plays pedal steel really well. He's a saxophone player. He's a fantastic singer and songwriter.
He's a good musician. Yeah.
He's all around, and he's, you know, doing a lot of, you know, kind of producing at his studio in Nashville now too. So he's kind of doing it all. But so he and I had done some tours together like that as duo. And kind of worked on some instrumental. We were sending stuff back during the pandemic, back and forth, like instrumental guitar pieces and like adding things. So we're kind of still working on that project. But yeah, I reached out to him and went over to his place and did some work. I had him play like a guitar solo. There's a song called You Should Come Over or something like that on there. He did the solo on that, and he played some really beautiful pedal steel parts and sang a little bit of harmonies. And yeah, so he played on it. There's a guy named Scott Moore who is an incredible violin player and arranger, and he played on my last record. He used to live in Louisville and now he's up in the Northeast, but I sent him the songs and he sent back these gorgeous like string arrangements. So there's two or three songs on the record that have string parts, and that's all Scott. And then Russ Paul played pedal steel on one song. You know Russ Paul?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he played on one song. He played on that song, Where Were You?
That was one I was going to ask about. That's a good
idea. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's about it, I think. I hope I'm not leaving anybody out. I think that's the list. What do you want to know about Where Were You?
I just like the sound of it. I mean, it just kind of stuck out. You know, like I said, I listened to the record a few times over the weekend. I just really like the sound of that song.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the origins of that one?
That one, there's a little part in that that kind of is telling about the whole record, actually, because I wrote a lot of the record. I live out in the country, outside of Asheville, kind of near, we're close to the Blue Ridge Parkway. sorry. And there's a like a, there's a mountain called Mount Pisgah that we're kind of really at the foot of. But I wrote a lot of the music in this cabin that's like right around, my friends own this cabin around, you know, about a couple miles down the road from us. And during the pandemic, they were letting me use it to write in and just gifting it to me because, it, you know, I'm home slowly going broke, you know, not able to do what I do and had to cut my last album cycle short and everything. So they were super generous in allowing me to use this space. And so that part of that song is talking about that. There's a place that I go over the hills and up a gravel road. It's like, you know, right around the corner from my house. But some of that song I'd had for a while, there was a couple of lines that I carried around for a long time. And then it all just kind of came together when I went up to that cabin and got a little bit of space and was able to kind of get my head together to do some writing. I have a couple kids and a wife and two dogs and two cats and a bunch of chickens and
say no more.
Yeah. Sometimes you got to get away.
Yeah.
I was about to say the room you're in looks conducive to writing, but then I was thinking, I'll bet he's got a wife and kids.
but I mean, the problem is this room is conducive to writing. It's right down the hill from my house. When I moved out of this house, it was a smaller house than we were in before. So I built this place to put musical equipment in, but as I'm looking out the window, I'm looking right at my house. And when I'm here, I just want to go up and hang out with them. That's the problem. Like, I'd rather, you know, a lot of times I'm just like, well, I wonder what they're doing. What are my adorable children up to right now? I'd rather, you know, go play with them. And so it helps to get a little space, but it was nice to be so close to the house in case they needed me. Cause it was kind of really, and still is a kind of a messed up time. And like, I didn't want to be far away from them, you know?
Understandable. But even being a couple miles away, you can at least get into a thing easier. I can understand that, other than looking at your back door from where you're at. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Did you actually build that yourself? I mean,
a friend of mine and I built this. Yeah. Me and one other friend who I've known forever, He's also a builder, and we did this over the period of a summer. And it was the first time I'd ever built a building from the ground up. So I'm really proud of it.
And that's awesome, man.
Yeah. It's like 16 by 20, just, you know, enough room to overpack it with stuff and have people, you know, I can fit a band in here and practice. And
I have a dulcimer almost like that one you've got hanging there.
Oh, yeah, a little lap dulcimer that my aunt gave to me.
Yeah.
I've got one very similar to that.
And room for a grand piano, too.
Room for a grand piano. That's actually the grand piano I had at my old house. And when we moved, I was like, I don't have anywhere to put this, and I don't want to get rid of it because I love it. And luckily we sold that other house to someone that I knew, and he was a musician. Said, hey, do you want to hold on to this for a while? So he kept it until I got this place built. And then that was the first thing that came in here was that piano over there.
How long did he keep it?
It took a while. It took me a while.
I think longer than he wanted to.
A couple of years. Yeah. Okay. But he loved it. He had fun with it. He teaches guitar and I think he was playing it a lot too. So.
Sure. So you mentioned wanting to be with your family stuff. So you were in Band of Horses for how long? 10 years?
10 years. Like, yep.
Wow. So how was that, being in a band like that was so busy and touring and being away, and, you know, what was that whole experience like?
It was really fun. You know, when it started out, it was, I was just still just dating my wife, and we are good at living our separate lives if we need to and being apart from each other. So it worked out really well. And it was wild. I jumped into something that that I never expected or even really dreamt of or hoped for in my career. It wasn't like, I didn't sit around thinking, I want to be in a rock, you know, in like a indie rock band. You know, it was just kind of something that happened. And it was a blast, and we were all wild. And, you know, I was the oldest one in that band the whole time. So it was kind of like, I was coming in and just trying to keep up with those guys. But But then after my daughter was born, it changed real quickly. And I, you know, priorities changed, and I would realize kind of like, I don't know. I mean, it didn't feel good to get on an airplane and leave for a month, you know? And plus when you're in a band that's rolling like that with five other guys or four other guys, sometimes five, you can't really say no to gigs. You know, you gotta like, you're not going to be the one that's like, I'm going to keep you guys from working, you know? So I was always saying yes to everything, like everyone else was. We're going to keep the ball rolling and like do as much as we can. And that was fine. But it just got a little bit, it got a little much. I didn't want to leave my family for a month at a time and come back. And my daughter's like done all these amazing things and I wasn't around for them. And
says the guy who can't even look at the back door of his house
without going up to see what they're doing.
Well, I understand that. Even, you know, reading about other writers that I really enjoy, like Randy Newman, absolutely had to unplug and sequester himself to accomplish what he did.
Yeah.
Well, I think it brings an important point. It's like, you know, the industry has changed, as we all know. It's gone from, you know, the focus of selling records to where all the money now is made on the road. And Dane can attest to this. He's getting ready to, you know, roll up his sleeves and hit the road with John again.
Yeah, we did 77 shows in 5.5 months last year. My kids are all grown, though.
Yeah, yeah. But still, I mean, still, that's exhausting work.
Yeah, it's hard for a guy that's almost 65, that's for sure.
Yeah, I thought you were almost 80. At 65. Okay.
I just looked that. But actually, I looked 45. But hey.
No, but all jokes aside, I mean, I can completely appreciate that. And most people don't think of it that way because they think of the glitz and glamour and all the things that you think are associated with it. And it's like, well, yes.
Get a clue.
But
yeah.
But and the important part is the but part, because there's all kinds of, you know, factors that weigh into that decision.
The performing successful is always wonderful, right? It's just the other 23 hours of the day
that little tiny window of time where everything else just drips away, and that's what you're there for, and that somehow makes up for all the rest of it for a long time. It can carry all the rest of that stuff.
Now, how did you become a member of Band of Horses at the time? Because they had already had a few records out. I don't think I know that story.
So they had put one record out, and then. Okay. They had finished recording the second record, and I was working on my second solo record called A Long Dream About Swimming Across the Sea in the same studio where they were working on Cease to Begin, which is their second record. So we crossed paths in the hallway. Like, I think I was leaving and they were coming in to do a session, and I'd finished up a session. And then when they were finishing up that session, I was coming back in to maybe wrap up my record or whatever. So, me and my friend Bill Reynolds, who ended up being the bass player in that band, we were both just Asheville guys that had been doing a lot of different stuff, but, he ended up kind of like hooking up with them and, starting to play. And then shortly after that, I had driven him to Charleston to rehearse with those guys, and then just got asked to play guitar. I think they had some shows coming up where their guitarist couldn't make it. And I was like, I'll fill in if you want, you know, I can try. And then, the conversation just turned to like, do you want to play guitar in the band? And I was like, let me think about it for a minute. Called my wife. I was like, I don't know. I was getting ready to put that record out that I was really proud of. So I didn't know if it was the best move at the time, but mm-hmm. It turned out to be a great ride. It was fun. You know, we had a good time for 10 years. And
yeah,
you know,
what was your solo record at that moment? What was that solo record?
My solo record was called A Long Dream About Swimming Across the Sea.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I joined them right before Cease to Begin was released. So both of those records kind of came out around the same time. And I was able to kind of open some shows and, you know, get my music out a little bit, but not quite as much as I probably should have, you know. But it was great. It was a great opportunity. And, you know, it was fun while it was. And then, you know, bands are hard to keep. It's hard to keep communication open with five guys and, you know, stay focused and stay friends, and things start to get messed up after a while. And that's just kind of how it all went down. And then now,
well, you wrote some really great songs with them, co-wrote some really great songs with them while you were in the band.
Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, Dilly is still one that I listened to, driving yesterday with my boys, and it's great. There's nothing else like that song. I mean, where the hell did the name of the title come from? That song?
That's so funny. I just drove past there the other day. I wrote that song. This is bad. I wrote that song in Dillsboro, North Carolina.
Okay.
So it's called Dilly.
Okay.
And that was just my, I think I was using GarageBand, and I think I typed in just to document whatever song, when I recorded the demo or whatever, I just typed in Dilly.
Okay.
When I sent it out to them, it was like, it was called Dilly, and then it just stayed that way.
Okay. Well, so it's not about the Good Humor ice cream bar.
No.
We used to have the Dilly Man drive around. That was
Dilly bars. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Dilly bars.
Okay.
Wow.
Man, yeah. I didn't think about that. Yeah. No,
you have to be my age to understand that.
It was a cabin that I stayed at in Dillsboro on a river, and I wrote a few songs there. And
that makes sense.
That was one of them, yeah.
Shut In Tourist.
So you didn't dilly dally. You went ahead and got that song written.
Oh, brilliant. Right.
But you know, hey, sorry.
Dad joke of the day. There you go.
That's right. Or maybe the month. I don't know.
Yeah. Shut In Tourist. That's another one that I really like as well. I think it's
brilliant. Oh, yeah. I kind of am trying to remember what that even sounded like, but I think that was on it. Yeah.
It's a good one. I listened to that one again, just over the weekend.
Yeah. I wrote a couple that were just me on that first record I did with them was Infinite Arms. And we used a song of mine called Evening Kitchen, which was kind of the first time that we'd done anything that was just, I really wanted it to be like, I never wanted to push that band in any direction. I wanted to kind of like go with the vision of what Ben had in mind for that band. But that song, I was like, oh, we should just do it like one acoustic guitar and two vocals. So that was the first time that band really like, there was like a real big breath in that moment. I mean, there was some beautiful music on all the records, but like that, you know, and a lot of it has a lot of space, but to go just straight acoustic guitar and two vocals, that was kind of a new thing. And it was a fun one. I still play that. I ended up redoing it with a full band on the last record I put out and called it Eden Country. It's got like pedal steel. It's got Russ Paul playing pedal steel. And
oh, cool.
Yeah. Some cool stuff on it.
Have to check that out. Well, the one song back to the new record that stuck out to me, and you know, obviously Dane has to play Mellencamp Small Town, most nights when you're on the road.
Yep.
I don't think we ever not play that one. Yeah.
Yes. But we were a small town. When I saw that, obviously I immediately thought of, you know, what small town is, you know, that's what always comes to mind is John's song. So that's a good one though. I mean, talk about that one.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, it's kind of a tribute to this town, you know, which is Asheville, but and that feeling that everyone has where they're like, there's a period of time that you have in a town that it just seems like, oh, that was the magic time. Or, you know, it could be now, like you could be like in love with wherever you're living. But that, for me, there was a window of time in Asheville where like me and all my friends were living in random crappy loft apartments and like paying cheap rent. And when it was cheap downtown and like we could all still afford it. And there was just this magic in the air. Like we were all playing at the same club and I met my wife at that club and, you know, all, so I wanted to kind of like write about that. And then a lot of it's about my family and some of the difficulties that we've, you know, weathered over the past few years and just things like that. So I tried to like make it a love song about my town and a certain time. And a love song about my family, and it's kind of what that song is. Yeah,
it's a good tune, really good.
So really I've got good. A question about Asheville, and I mean, I've been there quite a few times. I actually play, and I've I've been there with, I was there with the Ghost Brothers. I don't think Mellencamp's ever played there, but I've been there. I played a theater or something when I did the Stephen King play that he and John did. But I also played it with the guy that I produced a record for about 12 years ago or so in a pizza place there that has live entertainment. It's a great big pizza parlor that's got an outdoor area.
I'm trying to think of what that would be. It could be a Mellow Mushroom. Is it one there? I don't know. There's
a place. It was a full band. It was like an 8-piece band. So there was a pretty big stage.
Barley's. I don't know. There was a Barley's pizza place that had bands. I don't know. How long ago was it?
It was at least 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, man, that's tough. I just wondered
if it was still. Yeah, it's probably changed. And then is the Moog place still there?
They have like a cool little museum now in town. It's really small, but it's like, you know, a museum dedicated to Bob Moog. And then they have the factory. It's real right outside of, it's on the other side of the highway from downtown. And
yeah.
So they're doing all that stuff. Yeah. And they're still present here. I used to go see Bob. I knew him while he was still alive. I didn't know him well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When he was running that place, it was like this really small little office space, like down the river road, like out kind of near, it was just like way off the map. And it was really cool. There were like maybe six people in there and he'd be in the back just messing with stuff, tinkering around, and got to go in there a few times. I used to take bands that would come through town. I'd be like, you got to go check out Moog and go in there and check out what they're doing. And I'd bring people in there. But yeah, he was always really, really cool and sweet. So his legacy lives on in this town.
It's a neat town for anybody that's not been there. Asheville's like, I don't know. It reminds me of Bloomington, but except it's even hipper than that.
Oh, really? Nice.
Yeah. It's just a cool, I don't know, vibe.
Yeah, it's a good spot. It's definitely like me trying to figure out which pizza place. I'm like, I don't know. Especially if I played at a brewery, I'd be like, man, that's your guess is a good mine.
Right. They're everywhere. And it might have been. I can't remember. Does John Paul Jones still live around there somewhere?
Oh, what? I know that he was.
He lived there for years.
I didn't know he maybe he's still here. There. I knew he was like playing with people and he'd show up at like Merle Fest and do all that stuff, but I didn't know he was living around here.
I thought he had a place.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Around there somewhere. Yeah.
Wouldn't be surprised.
John Paul Jones, as in Led Zeppelin, John Paul Jones?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no other.
No, I'm just asking. I spent a day with him one time. It was pretty awesome. I had to pick him up for an interview, radio interview. And his manager at the time, I forget the guy's name, was sick because he was supposed to come with us. So I go to pick him up at the hotel, take him the radio interview. And he's like, I can't make it. I'm sick. So it's just you and John. I said, okay. So we go do the interviews. And I'm thinking he's going to want to bust it back downtown because he hardly talked on the way to the radio station. And after we're leaving, he goes, I'm kind of hungry. You want to go get something to eat? I'm like, sure. I'm thinking fast food. He goes, oh, no. Let's go to a sit-down place. So we go to the sit-down place, this restaurant, close to where my wife and I lived at the time. We used to go there all the time. So the bartender and the owner knew who I was, knew what I did. There was one other guy in there sitting in the corner drinking coffee. Me and John Paul sit down. He comes up, he takes our order and hears the British accent. I get up to go to the men's room and he corners me. He goes, hey man, who is that? I said, it's John Paul Jones from Led Zeppelin. He goes, really? And I go, yeah. I said, oh, man, that's so cool. So I go and sit down, brings us our lunch. Pretty soon after, the beginnings of Black Dog come cranking.
Of course, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I look at John Paul, he looks at me and smiles. He said, it's okay, it happens all the time. Yep.
That's incredible.
That's my
story.
That's
great.
He's a talented boy.
Yeah.
Boy,
so you were born in Cincinnati, right? Do you have any other Cincinnati? How long did you grow up in Cincinnati or just born there?
No, I was there. I think we left when I was around 4 years old.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I still, gotcha. I still there's still a place in my heart for Cincinnati, even though I didn't really get to live there very long, but I've got a couple friends that live there and play in.
You seem more like an Asheville guy than a Cincinnati guy. No offense, but no offense to Cincinnati.
I mean, thought about it. There was a point where I was like, I wonder if Cincinnati, because Cincinnati's still like, it's seems cool to be affordable. At least it was a few years ago, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You're talking to someone who moved from Toronto down to to this state here, and I speaking
the
of
sticks.
Well, yeah, but I ended up building a lovely house here for the price of a driveway in Toronto. So,
oh yeah, yeah. Where are you now?
I'm in Newcastle. I'm 30 miles east of Indianapolis. So I'm about 20 minutes away from Dane. And then Andy's about 40 minutes away from me, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice. Now we're close.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm curious to know how invested you are, only because I design album covers and I've been an illustrator in this business for 50 plus years.
Your work is incredible, by the way, man. I
thank you.
Was doing my, doing my research and I was like, oh, man. Okay.
Thank you. Thank
yeah.
You, that's a very neglected website, but thank you. I haven't delved in there for 2 years. There's a lot of new stuff, but yeah, thank you. But I care about how the visual speaks to the, you know, the, I won't say the consumer, but when you go into a record store, I come from an era where the front racked albums would speak to you, go, oh, I never heard of that band, but I love the cover. And that would make you consider buying it. How invested are you in your own visuals when it comes to, you know, when I look at, found a picture of you, I love the butterflies in the wallpaper. It's a great, yeah, very beautiful little image. I even like, you know, things are great, you know, it, going back to, you know, Band of Horses.
Oh yeah.
I love the irony of that image, because I've been a huge fan of Twin Peaks and that kind of, that seedy, that creepy underbelly of seemingly benign suburbia.
Right. You know? Right.
So I'm curious to know how invested you are in coming up with all these images.
I am extremely invested in it. I feel like it's a really, really important part of making an album. I think it's just hand in hand with naming songs, or like, it's, you know, it's, to me, I want it to connect with the content of the album. So it really, like, it's hard for me a lot of times to like decide on the images. Eventually they kind of come about and really, like, when I realize that they make sense, then it's, you know, go time, and I'll pursue, you know, get with someone that actually knows how to make like this, whatever vision in my head.
Right.
You know, well, real. But
you come from a time when, you know, 12 by 12 was the album cover, and that was all there was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people sort of mistakenly say, well, with streaming now, you get that two-inch square image in the bottom left corner of iTunes or iMusic or Spotify. But then there's the whole mindset now that every song warrants an image. So looking at Peter Gabriel's last release, there's new artwork for every song he releases. So that's, for me, that's the gift that keeps on giving. It's an opportunity to say, well, that's a great title. I wonder how I would treat that visually. Right. Oh, and there's 10 of these. Oh, great. So I guess to me,
I start to get overwhelmed at that point, because I'm like, it's hard enough to like come up with to settle on the album cover and know that it's kind of represent this
Andy,
body of work. But
give Tyler my phone number.
Okay, there you go.
Definitely. Oh man, I would love that.
I would love to. I would absolutely love to work with you.
Yeah. Oh man, that would be fantastic. Yeah, I'm so into representing music with the visual side. I think it's such a, it just connects it in a way. I mean, that is hard to even explain. But once I settle on an album cover and then I see it come to life under the hands of somebody that knows more about that kind of thing than I do.
Well, don't be unsettled by the fact that a lot of my clients are people like Megadeth, Iron Maiden, and Rush. I've always been a huge fan, probably a greater fan of people like Joni Mitchell, Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt. You know, not that I've received calls from any of those people, mm-hmm, but that's where my heart lies musically, you know. And
yeah, yeah.
I've had to talk a few kind of organic musicians, folk type musicians off the ledge when they were introduced to me. You do that rock stuff, you know, you do.
Yeah.
So I have to kind of say, I may do that, but you know.
Yeah, you can do other things.
Yeah,
he's not a one-trick pony in a Band of Horses. Come on now.
Boom.
Hey,
that's two today.
That's two of them. Number two.
Can't wait for the third.
Hey, oh, it's brewing. It'll pop. It'll come forth here.
Well, so what's the plans for the new record? You going to tour behind it all year?
I'm going to do my radically. Best. Yeah. I've got, it's just starting to get real busy. I was down here in this room kind of looking at my calendar and starting to realize that I was getting behind in all the things that I need to do, and realizing that, the schedule is very full, and it's lots of touring coming up. I've got, about a month of touring right off the bat, and then with a break in between. So I come home and see my family without being gone for too long. But and then we're going to try and fill up the summer looking for, hoping to maybe connect with somebody that's doing bigger shows and do some opening acts, John Cougar Mellencamp, whatever,
Yeah. People like that.
But,
yeah.
just
an idea.
Get out, play for more people and then get some festivals and a couple trips to Europe in the works.
Nice.
I want to do everything I can, because there was a long pause in my career for the last few years. So it's nice to.
So who is we when you say we're going to be on tour? How big an outfit are you? How big a band?
Depending on what I can do, what I can, kind of sensibly make happen. I'm either going to go out as a. I love doing solo shows. That's something that I've kind of honed over the years. So I can go out and do solo shows and not leave people really wanting too much, because the songs are kind of designed to live in that world. Like,
clearly. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, sure.
But I also, I plan on going out as a duo with my friend that plays pedal steel and guitar and sings harmonies. And then my full band is going to get worked out as well. So I'm going to, as soon as I get some dates lined up with them, it'll be, bass, drums, my pedal steel guitar guy. And I have this new friend that's playing vibraphone and keyboards
and
rhythm guitar too. So that adds a whole new kind of beautiful element to the show. So we've got a cool band, we just need the proper place to take it to and play. So.
When did you do that Pace Studio Austin back porch thing?
Oh, yeah. So I know the one you're talking about. Yeah, that was South by Southwest in 2019, I guess.
Oh, fairly recently. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Because when you say honing your solo kind of acoustic skills, I was going to say, well, if you told me you did that in 2013, I would say, oh, my God, you were that good then. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been. I always want my songs to live on a guitar and a vocal. Like I want to be able to go play them for people and just playing by myself. And they're like, oh, that's a good song right there.
That's my
goal. I'm writing. And the two, the guitar and the vocals interacting with each other in an interesting way. And the finger style stuff adds to the ability to make that an interesting show.
That also adds to the complexity of pulling it off too, being able to separate the two. I've always admired, that's going back to Bruce Coburn, for example.
Who's the first artist that you paid to see in concert that you really wanted to see, that you were excited about?
Oh, the first one I paid to see. There's some wild picks I could pick from high school, but I'll think about I used to go see Michael Hedges when he was still playing shows, and I got to see Leo Kottke a bunch of times. And those guys, every time they would come through town, I would choose to go pay money to go see them. And that I'll lead into a little tiny short thing about Leo Kottke, is that my vision of what I do as a musician and what I expect out of what I've been putting into it is fully based on seeing Leo Kottke pull up to a venue in Asheville that used to be here called Be Here Now. And he pulled up in a rental car with two acoustic guitars in the trunk. He got out, popped his trunk, grabbed his guitars, went in to the club, and it was, you know, it was a sold out, reasonably sized, you know, pretty small listening room, but just blew everyone's minds. And then walks out by himself, puts his guitars back in the trunk, and off to the next show. And to me, that was when I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to do that. So when I got to do all the Band of Horses stuff and the big traveling and like buses and trucks and, you know, it just, it blew my mind. Cause I never really expected all that stuff. And I still really don't. I still like, I like the idea of, traveling light and being able to interact with audiences and have like this really cool experience that, you know, is really kind of like just treading lightly on the earth.
Well, that's the nature of an acoustic guitar. They're beautifully portable. Just be glad you're not a keyboard player.
I'm a keyboard player too, but
B3 player in this particular.
Wurlitzer gets lugged around a lot. I bring the Wurlitzer out to shows these days. So that's about the heaviest piece of gear.
That's heavy enough.
Yeah.
Those whirlies aren't light.
Okay, sure. When I say keyboard player, I'm thinking back of the days when you actually did have a Mellotron, a Fender Rhodes suitcase, yeah. CP70, Oberheim synthesizer, Prophet 5.
Someone has to lift you into the center of all your keyboards and
pretty much and lift you out. So are you trained piano player?
That's how I got started, actually. As a kid, I just would. I think I ended up with a little keyboard and then my parents got me lessons with a jazz teacher when I was probably like nine or 10. So I learned to like use my ear a lot and solo around and improvise. And that's kind of what got me excited about music was that idea of being able to express yourself and improvise and use your ear too.
And you learned how to read?
My reading is very limited. I wouldn't even say I know how. I can read charts and stuff a little bit, but most of what I do is based on trial and error and using my ear and just kind of coming up with that. Yeah.
So. You're lucky your parents understood, or at least hooked you up with a piano teacher that took you away from just playing the conservatory fly shit on the page. And, you know, and that's good. Learning to read, which is something I did. And I studied for 8 years. Mm-hmm. But during that period of time, my father would always just say, play for me. And I'd go to get some sheet music out. And he said, no, just play. I've heard you playing on your own. And sure enough, that was an introduction to the responsibility of noodling with someone listening, you know?
Yeah.
It's one thing to noodle and to work out ideas on your own in private, but it's quite another thing for someone to say, play for me. Noodle constructively and entertaining.
Yeah, you know? I think it was such a blessing to have not only parents that put me in the right place, but to have a teacher that recognized that I had a decent ear and worked with that and to not be thrust into that rigid environment, because I feel like I wouldn't have continued music if I wasn't able to have fun with it and just kind of explore and it was way more exciting to just to find my way around and be able to, you know, do what I wanted to do. And I'm sure it doesn't work for everybody, but for me, it kept me interested and made me want to continue. And I kind of carried that into what I did on the guitar as well. Just kind of like finding my way around and doing a lot of open tunings and things like that. So,
well, it took years for keyboards or piano to even become recognized or cool, because in the 60s, it was all about playing guitar, you know, and then you realize, wait, George Martin played that, you know, and well, who's this guy, Elton John, you know, and who's, you know, Mac Rebennick, and all these guys started coming out and making keyboards hip and cool. So it was great. Yeah.
Reasonably hip and cool.
Well, I was going to say reasonably, yeah.
Yeah,
let's not
now.
Get too far ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. Not get too crazy with it.
You're always picking on the elder here.
No.
The gray-haired guy, as Ace Frehley says.
Yeah. Right. he needs to get his monitor adjusted.
That's right.
I can tell that pissed you off, and he said
that. I know. That was funny.
I'm looking at Andy's beard and thinking, where the fuck does he get up?
No, look at that. He's
like, oh, the gray-haired guy down there in the corner? That's
Oh,
that
man.
Was great. Oh, man. Congrats to you, Tyler, on the new record. It's fantastic. You have a lot to be proud of. Continued success to you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, man, this was so fun, you guys. What a great conversation, and I really appreciate you guys having me on the show.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.